Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of our other episodes at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 3, Episode number 14 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin. Simon is away on holiday this week, but we're very lucky. Kaylee is back, joining us from what I presume to be snowy Canada. G'day, Kaylee.
Hello, it is actually snowy. It was snowing in Vancouver yesterday, so it's a bit of a winter wonderland, which is semi-miraculous.
Look, it's so romantic and so exciting. Good to have you back on the show after missing out last week. And returning by popular demand, mostly his own, but you get that, Steve Gray is with us here in the studio, former film reviewer for TV's Good Morning and blogger and cultural commentator at therealstevegray.com.
Kia ora, Dan. That was a lovely intro.
And borderline truthful as well. In today's episode of the show, Paranorman is a stop-motion animated horror, but it's not directed by Tim Burton. The Imposter is a too-weird-to-be-true, but it is true documentary from the Madman distributors. We'll be talking about that later on. Martin McDonagh, the writer-director of In Bruges, is back with Colin Farrell and their new film Seven Psychopaths. And Kaylee, you're going to give us the lowdown on Gangster Squad, which opens in New Zealand on Thursday, and also Rust and Bone, which you've seen while you're in Canada, so something to look forward to there. What's not in today's show, I expect you're wondering. I can tell you, we're not going to have any mention of the Golden Globes, the most pointless example of Hollywood ass lickery ever witnessed. What a load of old rubbish that is.
It's the worst, and it always has been, and it's never been a secret that it's a joke.
It is a joke completely. And you know that there are only 87 people that vote for the Golden Globes.
And most of the foreign media that are actually decent and work for decent publications
aren't allowed to be members. Exactly. My favourite tweet about the Golden Globes came from somebody who I don't actually know, but it was retweeted, somebody called Groovy Focker, spelt in the
movie way.
Did you know you could fit all 90 people who vote for the Golden Globes on a single bus and then light it on fire?
That's terrible.
Technically it was a mess as well.
Right.
But, yeah, Jodie Foster, that seems to be the big news, and, yeah, that was a non-story.
It's a non-story, exactly. It's not, because the thing is, right, is that we're about cinema on this show. We're about
cinema. Not gossip.
Not about gossip, and the Golden Globes doesn't appear to be about cinema at all, really. It's about show business and about the business and about boosting the egos of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association as much as it is about the A-listers that turn up. But anyway, so let's get on with this.
You've already said too much.
I've already, yeah.
For a man who had started by saying we're not going to talk about him, that was a good 4 minutes.
We're not. I refuse. Point blank. You can't make me. So what normally at this point in the program, we would be asking Kaylee what's in the mailbag. So why don't we ask Kaylee what's in the mailbag?
Yes. Well, speaking of our guest, Steve Gray, Sideways NZ, who also do a lovely podcast where sometimes they talk about film, their two-word review for our last podcast is Steve Gray. That podcast is our favorite one by far. Hashtag actors can't sing.
Lovely. Thank you very much for that feedback. That's good. Anybody else got in touch to praise or not?
Yeah, actually, we have a pretty full-on Twitter feed this week. I can't even, like, keep up. So
it's
good.
It must be like to be a celebrity, having people...
No, if we were celebrities, we'd have someone to read our Twitter feed.
Oh, right, we'd have a yes. Department, wouldn't we?
Yes. As far as two-word reviews go, we have a few of those as well. Reese Pie said, in anticipation of next week, podcast, saw The Master last year, and here are my two words: Emperor's clothes.
Yeah, nice work.
Yes, and also from the Merca, one of our regular tweeters, two word review for Life of Pi: pretty faith light.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That's what we were talking about last week as well.
Exactly.
Taking all the God out so they don't scare people.
Yeah, it's there if you want it, but it's not front and center exactly. Now it's weird talking to you and not being able to see you, because usually we can sort of signal each other across the table, but anything on Facebook this time around?
Not that I have seen, no. But it's doing good. I would like to do a shout out to all of our new Facebook friends. We are growing weekly, so that is wonderful.
What's it under on Facebook?
Cinematica Podcast on Facebook. So you can like us there, and you can join in the discussion and contribute. And in fact, there's an app, so you can actually listen to the show without having to turn Facebook off. You don't have to go anywhere else. You can actually do it from Facebook, one of the many ways in which you can listen to the show. So it's not
good on you.
It's not too bad. Yes, well, we like to be ubiquitous.
He has to be now. It's the 21st century.
Exactly. So Kayleigh, time for New Zealand's top five. What have people been watching?
Yes, it's interesting. Top five.
Well, it was certainly interesting last week.
Yes, it's pretty much the same as last week. so there's been some shifting around. So sitting at number five down from four, Rise of the Guardians. At four down from three, Jack Reacher. At three down from two, The Hobbit. At two down from one, Life of Pi. And in number one position, unfortunately, Steve, Les Mis.
Oh, of course it is. Oh, those civilians.
They are exactly. Oh. I went to see it on Friday night, and there were tears. There was laughter at all the bits that presumably the director
talked.
No, there was laughter at the comedy bits, amazingly enough. But there was a lot of talking through it. There was a lot of muttering going on
from
the audience, whether it was just to explain what was going on, or I don't like that bit, or I don't like him, I prefer so and so, or whatever. It was certainly a civilian audience is what it felt like. Yes, there were tears, and there was not quite applause at the screening I was at, but I have heard that people are applauding at the end.
My mother went to it. She's a trained opera singer, and she walked out. She couldn't stand it. She was so upset.
Yeah.
But let's move on. Oh, I saw The Hobbit. Can I say two?
Oh, yes, so, two words for The Hobbit, please.
Okay, three-word review. Cate Blanchett, slow. What is she doing wandering around that room for no reason and then doing all her dialogue? Like, a dragon is coming to Riverfen.
Because she's the only woman in that whole part. They just need more ladies.
Well, in the whole film. And actually, they had to drag her out of the other films. There's no other reason for her to be there except to get her to walk down the red carpet at the beginning of the launch of the thing. It is, it's funny, there's a little bit of distance now on The Hobbit, isn't there? Certainly here in Wellington, where it's almost impossible to criticise, because it is fundamentally our economy that's at stake. But I think there's a little bit of distance now. It's made us shit ton of money all over the world. I think everyone can breathe easy now that there is going to be, you know, that tap is not going to be turned off. So now we can have a bit of a laugh at its expense.
Yes. Because you have to.
All right. Talking of having a bit of a laugh, it's not Halloween, and yet we have a Halloween-y type movie coming up.
Don't you see ghosts, like, all the time? Who's a good boy?
That's not his chin.
The witch's ghost is going to wake up tonight. And when she does, she'll raise the dead.
You've got to use your gift of talking to the dead
to stop it.
This is crazy.
Do I look crazy to you?
Paranorman. Animated, stop motion, three-dimensional. And Steve, you really enjoyed this.
I loved it. I thought it was one of the best things I've seen for children since Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I'm so tired of children's films that are just so straight and narrow.
Bland.
Yeah, and everything's so white generally and very rich, and there's no... And, you know, and this is kind of like, it's a bit of a skanky town and it's a bit run down. Do you want to do this quick synopsis of the story?
Yes. Yep. Okay, if I can remember now, because this is a long time ago since I've seen it, but I can't remember the names of any of the characters. Okay. But
Norman lives in a small town and he can see dead people.
You can do this for me.
I just finished it yesterday. Norman lives in a small town and he can see dead people, which would generally not be okay, except everyone knows, so they all kind of tease him about it a lot, and there's people bullying him and stuff. But then it turns out that the town is actually cursed, and centuries ago, during like the Salem witch hunts, a witch was burnt. It's pretty full on for a children's film as well. And then I don't want to give away too much, because it is one of those films where actually lots happens really quickly.
But only Norman is going to be able to remove the curse, because only Norman can actually see the ghosts and therefore get the full story about what actually needs to happen. But it's about outsiders, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about outsiders and people who don't necessarily fit in, and people who are misunderstood. And I think it's very honest about those people and very accepting of them. And something you mentioned in the show last week is that this is the first animated film, the first big Hollywood children's film that has a gay character in it.
And it's not even that big a deal.
No.
It's sort of like the fact that Norman can see dead people cool and the fact that this character is gay cool. It's totally sort of accepted, and that's what everyone's wanted for ages. I must say, the stop animation is stunning. Mm. I'm so over sort of Tim Burton owning that genre and then making terrible films, Corpse Bride.
Exactly, Frankenweenie, which was a big disappointment. And I can see why this particular film, they held it back in New Zealand because... Frankenweenie was always going to be the Halloween
biggie.
Hotel Transylvania, which wasn't stop motion but was bloody awful, was also around that same time. So there were a lot of horror-themed films for kids, and I'm glad this one has waited because it's the best of all of them.
Easily. Best thing I've seen for ages. And I get so tired of like Pixar and Disney always having the same thing, which is friends will get you through. Because often they won't in the real world as well. And I thought this one was more about, you know, believe in yourself. Don't hang on to things that have happened. You know, you've got to let them go. Grow up as well.
Yes.
I think some parents will be worried because, you know, it does start with a zombie eating a woman just had brains on the floor. But, I mean, I've always said, whenever I've reviewed children's stuff, because I adore it, you've trained your children, so you know what they can handle. Probably 6 or 7 up, though, if not.
I would say so, yes. I went to see it while I was in London with the family of the people that I was staying with, and their kids were 8 and 11, and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
They were right into it. Absolutely the target market for it.
If your children are precious, then you know what I mean by that. They won't like it at all. But I think, you know, children that can handle stuff.
If they like going outside, playing in the mud, climbing trees, and all of that sort of stuff, they will. They'll get a big kick out of it. So interesting voices in this film. John Goodman, always a fantastic voice talent.
Elaine Stritch.
Elaine Stritch. Yes, exactly. Elaine Stritch, who is a legend, isn't she? And
if you've never seen her film, Elaine Stritch at Liberty, it's one of the best things about theatre and drinking while you're doing theatre and love and losing love ever.
Indeed, indeed. Bernard Hills, also a voice in this. Casey Affleck, one of the voices. And Anna Kendrick from Pitch Perfect. So, you know, we can maybe forgive her Pitch Perfect.
I just think animated stuff's been dead for a long time. I really think it's sort of... Pixar kind of murdered any kind of originality or difference in it. And so this is so refreshing, Paranorman.
Well, I think maybe you're right. We're going to talk a little bit later on about the failure of the Pixar movies that have been re-released in 3D that people haven't gone back to, and I wonder whether the Pixar formula, it was a machine that they were churning them out, and they were all incredibly satisfying. Like I loved Monsters Inc. for example when it came out, and Finding Nemo, but now you're starting to see the mechanics of what they're doing.
I think with Ratatouille it kind of turned a bit for most people. You're just like, this is the same thing over and over.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
Paranorman, it's fresh, it's different, it's risque. It'll make kids feel a bit naughty, I think, as well.
Yes.
Because you don't often have zombies and things. And it's got a beautiful end, and it's about something different than friendship will get you through.
And it's only 92 minutes long, parents. So worth bearing that in mind.
It's one of those films that, you know, if you know your child will like it, they'll love it forever and it'll become their favourite film. And you can use it to babysit.
Yes. And like a lot of great animation, there's an enormous richness in the detail, isn't there? So there's always stuff to look at when you do go back to it again and again.
And it's funny without being forced, and it's funny without that whole children won't get it. A lot of the humour doesn't... It's not like the whole separate two strands of a themes going through a film. All the stuff is there for everyone pretty much. And it works.
I'm gonna put you on the spot now. Actually, maybe we should just ask Kaylee in Canada whether Canada has Paranorman.
No, Paranorman was released around Halloween, I believe. So it has come and gone. But I think I've seen advertisements that it's coming out on DVD.
Oh, okay. So you're in that in between phase for.
Yes, it's one of those ones that fell in between for me, unfortunately. So I missed out. But hopefully, I'll be able to catch it when I get back.
Yeah,
next
well,
week.
let's hope that it does hang around a little while, because I know that not there's such a crush for screen space in New Zealand at the moment that if something isn't working, it's interesting when we did that top five that Rise of the Guardians was in the top five because I went to a screening a week and a half ago, and there were no children in that screening at all. You know, that was like there were 20 of us, and we were all grown ups. So something seemed to have gone a little bit awry there.
Isn't it cool though that we can now be open about loving animated features? Remember in the '80s, you were like,
"Oh, too cool."
Like
because you know, because you know what they were. They were Beauty and the Beast. That's why we weren't.
If you mess with that, I'm going to throw my shoe at you. How can you miss a Beauty and the Beast?
I hated. I went to see the 3D-ified version of Beauty and the Beast last year, thinking I want to see what this is all the fuss is about. You know, because I missed the Little Mermaid and I missed out on all of that when they came out. Loved the Lion King, but he says listeners will by now be getting to grips with the fact that Steve and I agree on almost nothing. But Beauty and the Beast is awful, and the music.
I love the music. It's Howard Ashman and the guy who died.
I don't care. And
the guy who died. How did you hate it, Dan? Heartless.
They did the scores for Little Shop of Horrors and things.
I know. I understand all of that, but. Now, last week when you were talking about Les Mis and you were complaining about how the lyrics are just the same theme repeated over and over again, Beauty and the Beast is no different from that. The songs in Beauty and the Beast are I'm big and I'm strong and I'm tall and I'm handsome. I'm big and I'm strong and I'm tall and I'm handsome over and over again.
Probably the biggest difference is, Daniel, though, the people in Beauty and the Beast can sing the songs. They use people like Angela Lansbury and Jerry Orbach, who are trained professionals, who can actually hit the notes and act. OMG, what an idea!
Indeed. Well, we've gone off track a little bit, and here I am put in my place.
Steve, you are hired for life.
Daniel's terrible.
Steve...
Paranorman.
Two words.
Lucky children.
Oh, golly, that's very good. I was going to say something along the lines of ghoulish grit.
Ooh, yeah.
Yes, for Paranorman. So that's definitely two thumbs up, and I'm sure Kaylee would give it a thumbs up if she had seen it. Next up on the show, we're going to diverge into something definitely not for children. We're going to go visiting some psychopaths.
Hey, what the hell happened?
Some punks jumped us.
Who are you?
Said they were looking for a little shih tzu. Then some other punk killed those punks. It's their blood. It's his puke.
You want to go to the bathroom? Clean some of the blood and the puke off you?
Put your hands up.
No.
But I've got a gun.
I don't care.
It doesn't make any sense.
Too bad.
All right, Seven Psychopaths, written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who, if you are familiar with the film In Bruges, which was a big, big cult hit, started at the festival about 4 or 5 years ago and then had a long run in New Zealand cinemas, and I think is still a big fave on the rental home video circuit. We've waited a long time for McDonagh to come up with a follow-up to that film, and I think his brother made a film called The Guard, which came out last year, and I think a lot of people felt that that was
trying to be In Bruges.
Yeah, and without I certainly felt that it didn't succeed, but a lot of people who maybe wanted something a little less edgy than In Bruges felt that The Guard was a palpably okay substitute. Anyway, I didn't. I wanted something that was going to be rough and edgy and dark and challenging
and funny, and you got that in Seven Psychopaths.
Yes, indeed. So Seven Psychopaths is about a screenwriter in Hollywood, an Irish screenwriter in Hollywood, who is trying to write a script, getting way too drunk at the same time. And, you know, they say write what you know, and I would imagine that this is pretty much pulled from Martin McDonagh's own life, sitting in Hollywood, cashing checks, trying to come up with the
idea, because all he's got's the title. Seven
exactly
Psychopaths.
He's got a title, but he's got no ideas, and he's got a best mate played by Sam Rockwell, who is insisting on giving him ideas, way more ideas than he knows what to do with, telling him stories, and he puts an ad in the paper, doesn't he, saying, "I know, are you a psychopath? Come to our house and tell us your story."
We should also say,
yeah,
that Sam Rockwell is an actor, so of course he's broke. And to make money, he steals dogs from people and then he gives them to Christopher Walken. And then when they put up the reward posters, they go and give the dog back and get the money, which is actually quite a...
It's a nice little scam, isn't it? It's a wheeze. And Christopher Walken plays a lovely old guy, actually. A very sweet...
It's a character that you think you know, not because of Christopher being insane, but just because it's called Seven Psychopaths and stuff. And by the end, you totally turned. And I thought that were quite a few of the characters in this film.
Yeah, they don't turn out to be what you think they are at all. Lots of surprises. So they discover that they meet a few psychopaths who answer the ad. They also meet a few psychopaths because of the fact that they kidnap the wrong dog, don't they?
Don't say any more.
No,
I think that's enough.
Right, won't go any further. They kidnap the wrong dog, and then things go off the rails.
And all the psychopaths turn up.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a fantastic cast of character actors. Christopher Walken, as we say, Sam Rockwell, who just steals every scene.
I haven't liked him
in
for a while, because I've always found him a bit actor, bit theatre, and always upstaging. Wonderful in this. But Colin Farrell,
lovely, because he's the centre. He's the sort of calm, bewildered core at the centre of this, and he's not doing the scenery chewing that everybody else is doing, and it's a nice little balance.
You have to have you know, when you've got actors like that.
Yes, exactly. And who else? We've got Tom Waits, isn't it? Woody Harrelson. Tom Waits is lovely.
Woody Harrelson's the best I've seen him for a while,
isn't he?
Yes.
And also, and it's very, very nice. Almost any film I reckon gets an extra half a star just for Harry Dean Stanton turning up, doesn't it?
The whole film, though, because I think it's called Seven Psychopaths, you have a certain expectation, and then they're all turned on their heads.
Yeah.
Within about 10 minutes, you're like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And that sort of happens at great regularities as you're watching the film.
Exactly. A regular guest on the show, Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times, her review of it was much more negative than ours. She really didn't like it. We should probably make the point that it isn't everybody's cup of tea, but Steve and I both really, really enjoyed it.
I thought it was stunning. I thought it was what it was saying about violence, particularly about guns and gun culture, and how people get off on things like, oh, I love my favourite psychopath is, you know.
It does. It twists. It's one of those films that you think is going to be a sort of cult Reservoir Dogs kind of hit, and then it subverts.
Violence isn't sexy. Violence isn't fun. If you're around it too much, it drives you even more crazy, and you'll actually get off it. And I think they're really important themes.
Absolutely. And I think even deeper than that, there's some very, very deep philosophical aspects to it, and in terms of spirituality, even
hugely, you know? Like, so there's stuff in there that you're kind of like, whoa,
and
revenge is silly, and, you know, it doesn't do anything
exactly. And so, and on that basis, this is a film that I could go back to and find more richness in, I think. And McDonagh, who is probably best known as a playwright, actually, with The Cripple of Inish Man and various other films.
Brilliant
that a brilliant, brilliant writer, and it proves once again, I think, that that he's a real cinematic talent. But I just wonder whether maybe a film that's been marketed in a way that is going to put off people that might get something from it.
You'd have no idea how smart it was from the ads. You'd think it was like a Reservoir Dogs. It's the perfect thing that you think it is, and then it's totally the opposite of that. And
that's
also,
right,
I'd say, compared to Django Unchained and how that's meant to be about violence and stuff, Seven Psychopaths succeeds so much better than Django tries to. It says a lot more about the nature of man.
We haven't talked about Django Unchained because it hasn't come out yet in New Zealand,
I just thought
a little bit of pre.
Yeah, but I just thought, with all the raving that's going on at the moment, I didn't expect much from Seven Psychopaths. And also, I usually hate films set in the film world, because it's like, I don't care about these white people.
Well, that's true too. But one of the things about it that
it
really liked was its LA-ness. That it wasn't about Hollywood so much,
true,
but it was about Los Angeles, and it had a really fantastic sense of place. I got a sense of what Los Angeles is like as a place to live and try and do business and try and
survive
and exist in. And you know, so often people make films set in Los Angeles, and they're
clean.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, to be honest, that's something that Reservoir Dogs did do quite well, I think, way back when, was that sort of strip mall, back alleys,
flat, low, and out in the suburbs. Yeah.
Exactly. So, look, a big
stunning cinema. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and I think that it may be another reason why people aren't responding to it particularly well, is because it's sort of snuck out, you know, across this busy Christmas period, and I don't know whether this was necessarily the right release time for it.
I've also got to say, I was kind of excited because I love Mbouge, and then after the reviews came out, I kind of went a bit, oh, maybe not. And now, having seen it, I'm like, that's right, never listen to reviewers.
Exactly.
The other thing I've always said is find a reviewer that actually, you know, as similar to you in views and stuff, and then always trust them, because they do often sell films as what they're not.
Yeah.
And so you've got to actually know what they're like. The scenes in this are brilliant.
Kaylee, the people of Canada, how have they responded to Seven Psychopaths? Have they even had the good fortune to see it yet?
Yes, they have. I've been speaking to a few friends. It's unfortunately, this one lands in the middle as well, so I've already missed it here. Because as I said on the show, after I confused him with Colin Firth.
Middle-aged woman, but go after you for that.
I know. I'm not a Colin Farrell fan, and that's what I say to people when I talk about this film. They're like, no. You won't. Colin Farrell isn't being Colin Farrell. Colin Farrell's being interesting and acting, and it's good. So
there's a trick in his character which I can relate to about something he does that he maybe shouldn't do so much.
Yeah,
and I think it's really cleverly done.
And there's some quite extended discussions about it as well. Like there's some wisdom.
Yeah.
In this film, which you would be surprised. You would think that it would be very much the surface and humour and gags.
There's a heart to it.
Yeah,
and it never goes for cheap gags either. Like, even when they're like, there's a bit with Woody Harrelson and his dog that they could have gone for the obvious gay, but they don't. They sort of keep it in the characters as well.
All right, so I'm going to go with... I'm not going to let you get the first two-word review out this time because you steal the good ones. I'm going to say Seven Subversives.
I'd say Guns Kill. I thought its strong anti-gun rhetoric was brilliant, and violence. There's a great line where someone says, "Don't you wish you had a gun now?" to Colin Farrell, and he thinks about it, and then he goes, "No," because he just knows it would make everything worse if he did have a gun then, and guns do make it worse.
Indeed. All right, time for some news. And this time around, Kaylee doesn't have the news in front of her, so I shall be reading it for you in my best BBC voice. According to the LA Times, Disney have cancelled plans to transform The Little Mermaid into the third dimension. Recent 3D flops Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo and Beauty and the Beast have turned the mouse off what they thought was another cash cow after The Lion King made nearly $100 million a couple of years ago. They have announced the release date for Pirates of the Caribbean 5, though, so that's all right then.
Oh, no.
So mark the date in your diaries, July the 10th, 2015. For Pirates of the Caribbean 5, no word on casting, but if Johnny Depp's not in it, then it's going straight to video, I would imagine. Next piece of news, Japanese director Nagisa Oshima passed away this week at the age of 80, described by the New York Times in 2008 as Japan's greatest living filmmaker. Oshima is most famous in the West for In the Realm of the Senses, the sexually explicit sensation from 1976, and he also wrote and directed Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which starred David Bowie as a British soldier in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in World War II. Which, and incidentally, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, I remembered when I was doing a little bit of research for the show today, was shot in Auckland.
Yeah, but David Bowie.
Yeah, and features a whole lot of people I know.
And you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really sad. In Realm of the Senses, great
cinema. Yeah, so that's just a notable passing, I suppose. And the other, I was looking for news, and actually the only thing that anybody else wants to talk about is bloody award nominations and yada yada and Golden Globes, and we said we wouldn't talk about that, so we're not. So now it's time to pass the centre of attention away from Steve Gray in one corner of the room and over to the Northern Hemisphere. Kaylee, how has your cinema week been, or fortnight really, because it's a couple of weeks since we last spoke to you. How's your cinema fortnight been?
Well, last week was a bit slow because, like I usually do when I go on holiday, I got some strange childhood disease, which I'm still battling with. I got a dual eye infection, so I was not able to see anything because couldn't see.
Oh, my God. I was expecting, like, poison ivy or something. Oh, so your holiday.
I blame going to Target. I think I got something in Target.
So you're better now or you're still recovering?
I'm still recovering because it's one of those bacteria. Oh, this is going to turn into like the science show. The bacteria has moved into my throat, and so now I have throat inflammation as well. So I'm slowly recovering, but I can go out and about. So this week I was able to see Gangster Squad.
Oh, good.
And just before recording, which is why I feel a little bit slow, is I watched Rust and Bone, starring Marianne Cotillard, and what a powerhouse film that was.
That's the one where she gets her legs bitten off by an orca?
Yes.
Whoa.
That's right. And spoiler.
But that happens in the first 10 minutes, though, doesn't it?
Well, first 20. Anyway.
Daniel. Is it good? Is it good? Because she's a great actor.
Yes. Yeah, so, Kaylee, what did you think?
She is fantastic in this piece. She's completely stripped down to bare minimum. Like, I don't even know if she wore makeup for the shoot, but she just rips you apart and you just feel awful. But then she has this incredible transformation that, like, you just do not see coming, and she just full on becomes this totally kick-ass woman. So I don't think it's anywhere in the New Zealand release schedule, but if you get a chance to see it on demand, or if somehow get your hands on a copy of this film, you should definitely see it.
I've got a horrible feeling that it's going to be it's missed its window for the New Zealand Film Festival as well, and that by the time June, July, or July, August comes around, it will be more than a year old. So unless it's going to show up in the showcase, maybe at Easter, I suspect that big screen attention may be a little bit thin on the ground for it. I saw it at Telluride, and with Marion Cotillard. I wouldn't sit next to her, but she was in the room. And just stop me from being a complete tosspot, won't you?
Oh, no, I'm never going to stop that from happening.
But it was an extraordinary film. It's written and directed by Jacques Audiard, who made En Profit, which was a Cannes winner, and again got a very short release in the New Zealand market.
What's
which is a prison movie.
He made
Read My Lips many years ago, which is a fantastic film, a thriller about somebody, about a lip reader,
that's
a
great,
deaf
guy
and a lip reader. Fantastic film. He starts off with fantastic characters, and then he throws them into these incredibly tense situations and sees what happens. And so in Rust and Bone, we've got a bare knuckle boxer and security guard with who's sort of immature, on the fringes of the criminal community, got a son that he doesn't really understand or appreciate what it takes to be a father, and he falls.
Yeah, talk about worst father of the year award.
Oh, really?
On several occasions throughout this film.
And yet his journey is as interesting as hers. She's a trainer at the local SeaWorld, working with the orcas, with the killer whales, and in an accident she loses her legs. The best missing legs special effects that I've ever seen in my
better
life.
Better than the 1977 Richard Harris starring Orca, when Bo Derek, with her leg in a cast, gets eaten off by the orca. Is it better than that?
Better, okay. I have to say.
I'm sure
probably
it
not
is.
As camp. Probably yeah. not as camp, but still. Although there is...
Is it gory, though? Because I know I'm sometimes...
No, not gory.
No, it's not graphic
cool.
at all.
I think that's good to know, because
yeah,
that can sometimes...
Yeah, it is. And there's this extraordinary scene where she returns to the pool where the accident happened, and she's...
Oh, my gosh.
And
I almost cried during that part.
I know. It's just absolutely amazing, and it's Katy Perry, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of
it's the best use of a Katy Perry song
really
in cinema ever.
The big
this is a really interesting use of Katy Perry. Way to go, Jacques Audiard. Like,
the big question I had when I heard about a woman gets her legs bitten off, it recovers, is that it was going to be like pity porn? Is it?
No, it's
no.
much more.
So
it's much more.
She comes back so badass.
Cool.
Yeah, it's the making of her. You know, as a character, and you can see that she stops being somebody who's sort of pushed around by life, and somebody who discovers a lot about herself. But it actually, it's the guy, I reckon. There's a lot of talk about Marion Cotillard for Academy Awards and such like for this, and I just feel like she's almost amazing as she is. She's a supporting actor
to
the guy. Matthias Schoenaerts plays the lead, and he is just absolutely fantastic and amazing. And it's really his journey that we follow through the film, with her sort of weaving in around around him. So that's the way I sort of my perspective on it. Rust and Bone. If you do get a chance to see it, you really should. It came second, whatever that prize is, at Cannes to Amour.
It's called the Bum Dior.
Yeah. But Amour won the main prize. Rust and Bone didn't. And because it's a little bit tricky, a little bit challenging, I don't think anybody in New Zealand's really picked it up, which is a big, big disappointment.
But you both think it's really worth seeing?
Definitely worth seeing. And Marion Cotillard, if you think that she's sort of been coasting for a while on that whole Batman thing, then it's worth taking a fresh look at her, I think.
Cool.
So Gangster Squad, Kaylee.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of hype around this film internationally, I would say, because I know there was still a lot of hype around it in New Zealand before I left. And also the whole scandal with the Aurora shooting, and this is the trailer that was cut, and the date for it was pushed back.
Didn't they reshoot the whole end scene?
Yeah, there's they reshot that scene, the scene that was at issue, I think, and just wrote and directed a new one.
The end of the cinema, the end of the film was a big scene in the cinema shootout, but then Aurora happened, and they're like, "Well, we have to change the whole film."
Mm. Mm. Yeah, but so have people been going in Canada?
Yeah,
isn't Ryan Gosling Canadian?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, so is there a sense? Isn't there a whole sort of yay, Ryan?
Yes, probably. I think most when I went to the cinema, I've been going to afternoon screenings because it's, you know, a bit more convenient and it's not as busy. But I have to say, the most exciting part of this film was when Ryan Gosling's on screen. Like, I was.
Is it that bad?
I want people to go see it. I always want people to go see it and form their own opinions. But this is one of those films where the film just does not live up to the trailer. The trailer, they make it look really gritty, really dark, almost like a lighter Sin City, but it's not. It's wannabe noir thriller, but there's also comedy in it, so it appeals to more people, and it just came off as a bit too soft for me.
Trying to do too much, you think?
Not trying to do too much, but I thought it would be a lot grittier, a lot darker, but it just came out as really kind of... just
crap.
Soft. No, not crap. Not crap, but just soft. Like, so it appeals to more people. It was just really soft. And I wasn't really overly impressed with any of the performances.
But it's got Sean Penn in it. Look at these people it's got in it. Sean Penn, Josh Brolin, who's always really good.
Yeah, Josh Brolin's great. Please.
Josh Brolin's doing the Old Boy remake, so none of us are talking to him again.
But like Sean Penn, even I didn't really find his performance inspiring at all. It felt like this was an easy paycheck for him, honestly. It was really hard for him, but it was just like, maybe that's the measure of a good actor, is like he doesn't even look like he's acting. He just looks like he's showing up.
And can you understand a word Nick Nolte says? Because I haven't for the last sort of 10 years.
He's only in the beginning and the end. He's sort of like Martin Freeman in Hot Fuzz. He's just like, oh, la, 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 la. Oh.
But isn't it set in L.A. in the...
1949.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a really cool,
it should be
gritty,
stylish.
Horrific time.
It should be super stylish. Another question I have for you is, judging from the trailer, Emma Stone plays Jessica Rabbit. is that fair enough? Does she really look like she's got the sort of leading lady Veronica Lake sort of chops?
It's less Veronica Lake, more like Princess Peach, Lady in Distress.
Wow, that's good. You're good. I think she's a bit overrated, though, Stone.
Emma Stone? Yeah. I think we haven't found where her range goes yet, and where the limits are. Like, certainly in romantic comedies, I think she's very natural and very sort of... easy to watch on screen, but the question is what happens with the drama.
Like, yeah, what's that big drama she did? She hasn't done one. And if you say The Help, there's trouble going down.
No, I'll give you that one. Indeed.
So who do you think it'll appeal to, though? Who's going to go to it?
I think it'll appeal... I don't think it'll really appeal to critics. I think it will appeal to general audiences. If you like your noirs, if you like your thrillers, and you like your like crime drama... you may find it a bit of a dial-in, but
right.
I think general audiences will enjoy it and they will go see it. I don't know if they'll go see it more than once, but I think they will definitely pack out the theaters when it does open, because there's so much hype around it and because it's so styly and because that trailer is just so well cut together. And actually, speaking of trailers...
Mm-hmm.
And disappointing trailers. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you guys... I didn't listen to the show last week. I'm a terrible, terrible co-host. But
you had no eyes. Surely, what else could you do except listen to us?
I can think of a few things, so let's move on.
speaking of styly noir deco films, Great Gatsby now has a date.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yes, it is dated
2013.
Yes, it is dated for May here in North America, and it is being released in June in New Zealand. It's up on Flicks now. Mm-hmm. And they screened a new trailer, and the new trailer is terrible.
Oh, every trailer's been terrible.
Wow. Yeah, like the early Great Gatsby ones were good. Like you could tell the animation wasn't finished, so they've tightened up the animation, but it's this like long-winded trailer where they're trying to tell the story, the actual story, and it just is it's terrible and gets lost. Whereas the original trailer was about
images,
like yes, the images and like
and the feel of the 20s.
Yeah.
And tried to tell a story in this new trailer, and it's just like, this looks terrible. This movie looks so boring. So
I think there's been a few missteps, isn't it? And particularly the fact that it's had to have its release date moved a few times.
Yeah, it was meant to be in.
It was supposed to be Oscar bait this year.
Well, and they said it didn't want to open against The Hobbit, and it's like, yeah, because everyone is going to go to The Great Gatsby, is going to go to The Hobbit. Mm. I mean, it's hardly the same audience.
It does have such potential, doesn't it? Because the story is really good. You can imagine Leonardo DiCaprio as a sort of Gatsby figure. And there's some really good casting in there, some really interesting people.
Tobey Maguire?
No. I was thinking of...
Carey Mulligan, because you want to give her kisses and take her home.
Shush. The interesting casting in there is that guy Edgerton, who I think...
Joel.
Yeah, Joel Edgerton from...
He's popping from everywhere.
Yeah.
That's great.
And but Amitabh Bachchan is in it. He's got a little moment in the trailer, and I was thinking, who are you? And I actually went and looked him up. It's Amitabh Bachchan, the Bollywood superstar, isn't it? And so you know, so there maybe there's some interesting things to still be discovered about it when it comes out.
As soon as I heard they were doing new songs like Romeo and Juliet, I went, "Well, you're an idiot, Baz Luhrmann," because that time is so about the music, because music changed, and it was changing society through music. And I said, to throw in modern stuff is kind of losing a bit of a point of the time.
Let's review films that we've seen rather than ones we haven't seen. So, Kaylee, you're going to stay on the line with us and help us review The Imposter, even though you haven't seen it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that was forced.
Give it the old college
try. I would like to do nothing bitter. Damn.
All right. So
that was exciting.
Time to open the cupboard marked documentary.
He disappeared without a trace 3 years ago. Tonight, a San Antonio boy is back home.
When a child is missing for years, either the child is dead or the child is not found.
He was tortured. I mean, he had torture written off.
This kid's really messed up.
There was just something wrong about it.
Something was being hidden, and I didn't know what that was.
Right, that's the new documentary called The Imposter, which has been wowing people all over the world and played in the New Zealand Film Festival last year. Uh-huh. And I think that there was a lot of talk about it as a potential Academy Award nominee for Best Documentary, but that is a very crowded field. This is a film that there's in the sub-genre of documentary, which is the WTF documentary, where you just go...
Halfway through,
something happens, and you just go, what? Really? That happened? And you just get carried along by the revelations and the continued revelations. Films like Crazy Love, Deep Water, The Thin Blue Line. It was a very early example where facts just get layered on top of other facts, and you think this story just gets more and more bizarre the more you learn about
it. Capturing the Freedmans.
Ooh. Yeah. And so it's in very much in that mode. And
Let's
give you an idea about what went on. In 1997, I think, a young boy in a small Texas town went missing and was never found. And his family, oh no, it was 1994, wasn't it? It was 1994 he went missing. And the family were obviously grieving terribly. And then in 1997, a young man in Spain, a Frenchman in Spain, found himself in a homeless person's hostel and
identified himself as the boy.
He basically
stolen, molested.
That's right. He decided as a way out of the trouble that he was in.
Don't spoilers.
No, exactly. Got to be careful with it. Got to be careful with the spoilers. But basically,
you do find out.
He basically pretends to be this missing boy. When the family turn up in Spain to pick him up, they obviously clock that he doesn't look like the boy that they lost, but
had
a Spanish accent. But they just decide to go with it and just go. It's about, you could argue that the film is about people wanting so much to believe their own truth that they make. That they make it, you
and
know?
So you can kind of understand it. But then twists are happening and twists because he comes back to America.
Exactly. But so it's a very interesting character study. I think a character study of a guy who whose own life is so unsatisfactory to him that he'd rather be almost anybody else, and who spends his life transforming himself into other people. And it's also a really interesting character study of the family themselves as well.
I thought they were portrayed right from the start as quite negatively. I thought it was very much like, ooh, look at these white trash.
I think there's an element of that, but I think that also they're not uninteresting just because despite that. I think that and this whole idea that that they would not even question the truth that's been put in front of them.
And that's sort of the big revelation-y thing that comes in. I would have loved to have seen this material in the hands of Errol Morris.
Yes.
You know, he would have just knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, there's some very, I think, nicely handled reconstructions in there.
Oh, I hate reconstructions.
I hate them. I think that any documentary that resorts to it, I think, has lost something somewhere along the line. But I thought that the way that they were edited into the story itself, I thought was handled quite deftly. Mm. But the biggest problem...
What is it about it?
The biggest problem I think with the film, and I find this with a lot of modern documentaries, is that it so manipulates its story in order to maintain tension and keep a surprise. And when you finally get that surprise revealed, I feel that a little, like I've been deceived a little bit, that I've been sold a bill of goods, really. And this film, the final twist at the end, the final twist never comes, because I suspect that the ending that the filmmaker really wanted, he couldn't get. And as a result, it falls a bit flat at the end, even though it's been built up.
Felt there was stuff missing. Like, I mean, even though they keep saying that as well, I was like, there's part, and I think it's the boy himself. I think his story and his self is not in the story. And maybe with what, you know, happens later on, that's the reason. But yeah, it didn't.
Yeah,
it
he's an empty space, isn't there? A question mark around the whole thing.
And because, as you were saying, like, he's trying to be tricky, there's a lot of stuff that we should actually know earlier that we don't. I think they introduced the boy, the imposter, too early.
Yes,
it's like 2 seconds in, bang, here he is.
Yeah,
and I think they should have done it.
This is the thing is that it's told largely through his words.
He's a nasty guy.
Well, as we discover, and I think that that's where I felt cheated a wee bit, is that for fully two-thirds of the film, we're invited to believe that he's an honest broker, you know, that somehow he's...
Right.
And it's relatively late in the piece that you start to realise that he's maybe not to be trusted with this story. But meanwhile, by that time, you're invested. And I suspect that feels slightly dishonest to me.
I never trusted him right from the start with some of the stuff he was doing. I was just like, this is, I don't trust any of them, really. And that's the other thing, maybe Errol Morris is more skilled at editing them or something, so you don't judge them so much. I really thought this film was making...
It was not fair.
Yeah, it was like deciding things about these people based on money or whatever. All of the characters, though. I must say, if I ever do a big trick like this, I want an FBI agent. They're pathetic. She was ridiculous.
Were they useless?
Exactly. And then the cop with a vendetta. He's an idiot.
The private dick. Digging up people's back gardens. Yes, yeah, exactly. That was very strange. But he was like, he reminded me very much of the private investigator from Blood Simple way back when, sweat, fat and sweaty, wearing braces. And you think, you know, like, you're obsessed, but what are you obsessed about, really?
It's interesting. I don't know if it's wholly successful as a piece of cinema, though, because documentary is one of my favourite genres. I think it's really doing amazing stuff now. And it's not anywhere up there.
Yes. Two words for the imposter.
I'll go first.
Yeah. I will go first. So mine is cinematic imposter?
Okay. Mine would be better.
Well, that's told them.
Because I thought it was the guy who made Man on the Wire, which I was a bit about as well. So I went back and checked, but this guy's just done TV and stuff. I didn't actually
know
what
he's
done.
First feature. And also, if you look at his TV credits, they're in that sort of America's Most Wanted sort of genre, aren't they? So you think that he's accustomed to playing a few tricks on us.
He found the story, wanted to do something, but he's not skilled enough.
Yeah, not yet. Maybe next time. But what he did was he found a good subject, and that's half the battle.
It's still a amazing story. It's amazing.
Yes. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week.
I'm exhausted. I want to be in Canada with snow.
Yeah, it's too hot. It's too hot here in Wellington.
And friction, so I can't talk. And just settle sexy.
Next week on the show, we're going to be talking to some of the large Kiwi contingent who are at Sundance, which starts tomorrow.
Who's
so Taika is there. Mark Orbiston and the guys from Shopping, which is the feature, the New Zealand feature, is there. Brett McKenzie is there for what reason, I'm not sure. But I did get a list. The Film Commission sent me a list of the people who are at Sundance. So we'll be cherry-picking them and seeing if we can get some interviews.
Apparently, Don McGlashan and Harry Sinclair are going to finally sue the Flight of the Conchords for stealing off every idea the Front Lord had. I love the Front Lord.
I love the Front. I've got both of their records. I wish they'd made videos as well, actually, or like home video of their show. Like the stage shows were
fantastic. I saw the one at Corporate Theatre, which was there last night before the Jennifer Ward Leyland days, it was incredible. Yeah. They were skilled.
This is flying over the head of Kaylee, who hasn't been in New Zealand long enough to know who the Front Lawn is. We will explain later, and play some
of
the music later on.
They're real Kiwi.
Yeah. So next week it's the Sundance special, and we'll be talking about all of the other film releases as well. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes so that it arrives automatically every Thursday morning. Some people even listen on a Wednesday night, only about half an hour after I post it.
I'm getting
feedback, which is very, very nice to hear.
Are you doing the master next week, you suckers?
We should be doing something mastery. Yes, that would be good. To be honest, I haven't actually looked at the calendar.
I'm
way behind. So, Kaylee, how do people contact us to give us their feedback?
They can contact us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. And as always, at cinematica.co.nz, which is our website. And also, this is my last week in Canada. I will be on the show next week from Canada. So if there's anything that you see or you would like me to see while I'm here, please let me know. The big event I will be going to this week is to see Sukiyaki Western Django at the Rio Theatre on Commercial Drive, which now sells alcohol, which you can take into the cinema. So I'll be getting drunk.
So finally, Canada has caught up with New Zealand in terms of its grown-up cinema experience.
Yes. Oh, and there's also something I was going to talk about in the news, but I forgot. So I'll do it now at the end of the show where no one's listening. In BC, there is also now a kind of gold lounge equivalent at some cinemas as well. So you can go in and sit in these fancy chairs, and but the difference is it's grown-ups only, because there's alcohol being served. And also, at one of the big cinemas in downtown, the Scotiabank Cinema, which is run by Cineplex Odeon, who seems to run every single cinema in Vancouver just about. It's the biggest multiplex we have. It's this big monolith downtown. And they have this interactive game that you play. It's so dumb. Because it starts when the screening time is supposed to begin. And there's a warning that comes up during the pre-show saying, download this app. And then it asks you trivia questions, and you compete with other people in the cinema for prizes. And then people's scores of whoever's playing in the cinema with you come up on the screen.
What a great idea.
And you compete for prizes.
Hey, isn't that neat to encourage people to use their bloody phones in the cinema? I thought we were stopping that.
I know. They should. I hate it when I have to surrender my phone before a media screening, but I sort of wish it happened at public ones. You get the impression that cinema owners actually don't have any faith in the product, do they?
No. And it's all about these giant pre-shows and these interactive
little mini documentaries. When I was in the States, you'd walk into the cinema and they would be playing. I sat down and watched. There was like a 10-minute video preview of the new season of Homeland. And I'm sitting there thinking,
movies.
At the movies. And it was like one of those behind-the-scenes sort of things. And I'm thinking, why are you advertising the competition at your picture theatre?
I hate this whole TV's better than movies now. It is so untrue. When you get to a good one of those good films that touches you because it's right for you, it's nothing like it. And TV does not do that. TV's the opiate of the masses now. Film is...
Exactly. When I watch TV at home, I feel totally free to get up and walk around while it's on, to tweet while it's on. Even stuff that I enjoy, like Boardwalk Empire, I'm not really watching it to the same extent that I do when you're committed to a film. Exactly. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music from Oshima's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which we spoke about a little bit earlier on. This is the theme to that film by Ryuichi Sakamoto, Forbidden Colors. Thanks very much to Kaylee joining us on the line from Canada. Thank you, Kaylee.
Yay, thank you. I'll see you next week.
And thanks very much to special guest Stephen Gray. Nice to have you here again.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.